Okay, I'm going to call to order this meeting of the Senate Committee on the Environment and Natural Resources. Today is Wednesday, April 5th, 2017. Welcome, everyone. We have a combination of work sessions and public hearings today. And if you have your program, throw it away, because things are going to go out of order today. We're going to start with a public hearing and possible work session on HCR 14. We'll start with that. Actually, that is first.
That's right.
Perfect. So I just opened the public hearing on HCR 14. Beth, would you tell us what this bill does, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, HCR 14 would commend Tom Rumbrick for his years of service with the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Senator Roblin, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Arne Roblin, Senate District 5. I'll keep this fairly short because we have a lot of things to take care of and I have to go. Mr. Rumrick is probably one of the most influential, I believe, Oregon fish biologists. He came to Coos Bay and he actually worked in the Fish and Wildlife Services for 37 years, I think it is, and he made a concerted effort to try to teach kids about hatcheries and fish. And eventually, we built a new hatchery up the Coos River area. And he got the timber industry and all sorts of other industries together to buy the land and build this really amazing hatchery, which has a classroom. And kids from all over Oregon come every year to help pick fish out of the river, and it's fun to watch them wrestle these big fish and then spawn the fish and make the hatchery work. And we have this new fishery in our little bay because all these fish are coming back and they're coming up this little creek, and these kids are getting engaged in an understanding of what it takes to raise fish and what their life cycles are. He's been honored in a number of different ways, but a number of us from the coast decided this would be the best way to honor him from the legislative perspective. He changed a culture. Thousands of children in Oregon have a better understanding of this iconic fish, the salmon, and I commend this bill to you for consideration. And I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you very much, Senator. Any questions? Colleagues, the reason that we're hearing this House bill so quickly is because we're hoping to get it on the floor to coordinate with people to receive this commendation.
Yep.
So. Okay, seeing none, thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
Kurt, you want to come up? Oh, all right.
We have two Kurtz.
Lifeline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have our fish chief here with me as well, Ed Bowles, who's going to join in.
It's a real pleasure, Mr. Bowles.
Thank you. And I'll be brief for the record. Chair Denbrough, Senator Olson, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. We did provide some very brief written comments on House Concurrent Resolution 14. First, I wanted to be here today personally to express my appreciation of Tom's 37 years with ODFW and his diligent work in Coos County, express my appreciation to Senator Roblin and Representative McEwen for sponsoring this resolution and recognizing one of our employees who has recently retired. And I think Senator Roblin mentioned it a little bit, but Tom has been really built this program from the ground up in the Coos County area. It's really a model for these projects around the state. He's received, as you might imagine, numerous awards over the years. But I think perhaps the most meaningful was in 2015 when he received an award recognizing that over the years his program had educated over 100,000 Oregon school kids, and his work to connect students and their communities with Oregon's fishery resources is truly deserving of this recognition. So with that, I do have, as I say, my fish administrator Ed Bowles here as well. He may want to say a few words, and if Tom's watching online, because I didn't see him in the building here, he knows we've expressed our support and appreciation for his work.
Thanks a lot, Kurt. Ed, welcome.
Chair Dembrough and committee members, I'll keep this very technical. Tom's a rock star.
Oh, you have to give us your name, Ed.
I'm Ed Balls, Fish Division Administrator. Ed, I think just to follow up on what Director Melcher spoke about is really the model that Tom had is a soup of passion mixed in with partners that really caught on with that passion and that vision. And so I think he'd be the first to share with you that he alone couldn't have done any of what the outcome of this is for that Cuzco-Quil region. It's really about the partnerships, the funders, and the folks that kind of caught the contagion of that passion of fish all the way from kids to grandparents. And so it's a great legacy. As Kurt mentioned, I really appreciate the coastal legislators for their recognition of this, and big shoes to fill, but we're happy for his recognition.
Great. Thank you, Ed. Any questions, colleagues? Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. Okay, I'm going to close our public hearing on HCR 14, and I know this is unusual for me, but I'm going to open a work session on HCR 14 so that we can get this down to the floor. So, Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Dimmer, I move HCR 14 to the floor with a B adopted recommendation.
Vice Chair Olson has moved HCR 14 to the floor with a B adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there any objection? Seeing none, motion carries. HCR 14 will go to the floor. Senator Roblin will carry. And I will close the work session on HCR 14. Okay. All right, we have lost the carrier of our other two work session bills.
So we can
Senator Berger, how long can you stay?
Oh, I'll be here until 3:30.
Okay.
At least.
All right, he'll be back. Okay.
We're just going to start hearings. If so, I was going to step out. If we're going to do work sessions, I'm ready to do
that. We're going to do hearing. We're going to start our hearing on Senate Bill 847. Not 847, I'm sorry, 836.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to open our public hearing on Senate Bill 836. And Beth, could you tell us what this bill does?
Yes.
It's a little bill. It must be a little bill because it's the de minimis bill.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 836 would redefine de minimis level as a concentration of 100 parts per million for purposes of the Toxic Free Kids Act. It would also require legislative ratification of chemicals in certain children's products that OHA determined should be removed and substituted.
Okay, thank you, Beth. Okay, I'm going to ask Gabriella Goldfarb to come up from OHA to frame this. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. I'm Gabriella Goldfarb. I'm the Environmental Public Health Section Manager for the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm here today to give you information about Senate Bill 836, which proposes a number of changes to the Toxic Free Kids Program. The legislature directed OHA to develop with the Toxic Free Kids Act of 2015, SB 478. As Beth Petrino noted, at the center of the bill is a redefinition of de minimis level, or the level above which OHA must be notified of the presence of a chemical in certain children's products. My testimony that the agency submitted, goes into a lot more detail than I'm going to share with you in the interest of time, so I will summarize and will be happy to go into more detail if there are questions. The testimony includes a copy of 66 high-priority chemicals of concern for children's health that was developed through a science-based multi-year process through the Washington State Department of Health, the University of Washington's Pediatric Environmental Health Specialty Unit, and their state health department. These chemicals were determined to be the most likely to cause the most harm to the most children when found in children's products. The redefinition of the de minimis level to 100 parts per million would eliminate individual limits for those for 65 of those 66 chemicals, all of which for those 65 are less than 100 parts per million. So it would have the effect of removing the requirement to report to OHA at those individual limits that have been determined through that scientific process. I will say there is another de minimis level that exists for unintentionally added chemicals that is 100 parts per million. The reason there's a difference, the reason there's one de minimis level for chemicals that are intentionally added as part of a production process and 100 parts per million de minimis for those that are kind of byproducts, is the idea that a manufacturer has a much harder time controlling those chemicals that are just a byproduct of manufacturing, that it's much easier to control chemicals that are intentionally added to a manufacturing product. So I will move on to the three other changes that this bill would result in. The second change would exclude from notification any chemicals of concern that are found in an inaccessible component of the children's products that are covered by the law. And some of these products, such as flame retardants and epoxies, are known to migrate, so they could potentially migrate to the outside of the product or volatilize and be a source of exposure in that way. The third set of changes proposed by the bill would require OHA to duplicate the analysis that was conducted by the University of Washington, Washington Health Department, and the Pediatric Environmental Health Unit to produce that produced this existing list of 66 chemicals of concern, and this would require OHA to get staff in order to do that work. We would need staff that we currently do not have on board. We don't have the expertise or the resources to carry out that workload at present. The fourth change would be eliminating the timeline to phase out high-priority chemicals of concern. Actually, there's fourth and fifth, and eliminate the $250 per chemical fee that's currently adopted in rule, and that would eliminate funding for OHA to implement the core chemical notification portion of the program. So that is, at a high level, the changes that this bill would make to the Toxic Free Kids program, and I would be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Questions, colleagues?
Thank you. Thank you, ma'am, for your explanation. Has Washington State increased their standards from what they had in the past?
I believe that they have we tried to model the program as similar to the Washington program in most respects, the Oregon program on the Washington program. I think they have a procedure, as we have proposed, to over time be able to adopt changes to that list. But I'd have to go and I can go and find out for you whether they have made any changes. Are you asking if they've added any?
Follow up. When we did this bill in 2015, it was much more stringent than Washington State, much more stringent. So I was just asking if Washington State, if to your the best of your knowledge, if they have increased their look-see at the products.
Chair Dembrough, Vice Chair Olson, you're right. It is different. It is more stringent in that the Oregon program requires a phase out, which the Washington program, to my knowledge, only requires reporting at this time. And to my knowledge, that Washington program has not been modified to have that second phase that Oregon has.
One last question. Has California changed their chemical list? I mean, their chemical list is enormous, but have they increased the stringency of their policy to match Oregon?
Chair Dembrough and Vice Chair Senator Olson, I do not believe that California has the same type of reporting and phase-out requirement that we have in Washington and in Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
Gabriella, the issue of OHA having to redo the work that University of Washington did, how How difficult will that be? How expensive will that be? I'm starting to think about fiscal issues.
Sure. Chair Dembro, members of the committee, you know, it's a lot of chemistry, and OHA has health experts, but we don't have chemists on staff, and that would be a lot of what we would need to do this kind of analysis.
Well, I see a job opportunity here.
Fee increase.
No. It's my degree.
Okay, any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, we have a representative here.
So, thank you.
Is this your first time before this committee, representative?
As it's currently constituted, yes, it is, I think. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, and members of the committee. I'm Representative Alyssa Kinney-Geyer, House District 46. I have the southern half of your good chair's district. Thank you for letting me talk about Senate Bill 836. And as many of you know, I've been passionate about this issue and have worked on the children's toxics, some form of the bill in 2012, 2013, 2014, 2015. And I was delighted when Senate Bill 478 finally passed in 2015 with years of input from all stakeholders, with in-depth negotiation by the former chair of your esteemed committee, Senator Chris Edwards, with support from multiple scientists, healthcare professionals, environmental advocates, businesses, and consumers, and with strong bipartisan support on the House side. I'm here today because I oppose Senate Bill 836, which seeks to weaken some of the provisions set forth in Senate Bill 478. Some of the changes requested in Senate Bill 836 are provisions that some manufacturers wanted in the 2015 negotiations and did not get. While we accepted many of their suggestions, and I'm happy to go back and review with you some of those suggestions and that actually made it into the Dash 16 and Dash 18 amendments, we turned down the suggestions that we deemed harmful to the intent of the bill, which is to protect kids from toxic exposure. Other changes are ones requested in the Rules Advisory Committee, which had strong representation from industry. I was in touch with OHA repeatedly during the RAC process, including submitting a letter in October of 2016 to the committee to clarify intent. And I, along with this testimony, will be submitting that letter. I might note that DOJ also submitted a letter during that process to interpret OHA's draft rules as aligned with the legislative intent of the law. That will be part of my testimony that I will be submitting as well. Again, some manufacturers did not get the changes they sought in that process, and thus they are back with Senate Bill 836 to try again to weaken our children's toxics law. I think you can tell from my voice how I feel about this. It's very frustrating after 5-6 years of working on this. While others may remind the committee why a bill to protect children from toxics is so important, I'd like to reserve my time to help you separate myth from fact by sharing information about the law and its regulations. I think I'm going to skip pretty quickly over the law because Gabriella ended up going first, but I wanted to remind you some of the main things. It establishes a list. It was based on Washington's list, which went through very rigorous scientific review. We had all of that in OLA, so you could see where we developed that list from. But these were the chemicals, high-priority chemicals, that pose the biggest threat to children's health. They include heavy chemicals such as cadmium, arsenic, mercury found in toys, phthalates, which are found in soft plastics and cosmetics, and formaldehyde found in fabrics. The law was intended to publish this list on its website, OHA's website, with information about potential health impacts. After 2 years after publishing the list, it required the manufacturers of children's products that have gross annual worldwide sales of $5 million or more to tell OHA when their children's products might contain some of these dangerous chemicals. Main difference between our disclosure and Washington's law is that our law exempts manufacturers with global sales under $5 million a year, whereas Washington's disclosure requirements apply to manufacturers of any size. This was intended to do it so that we could let the smaller companies basically off the hook and say the larger ones are really going to move this arena. By January 1st, 2022, nearly 6.5 years after passage of our law, it would require manufacturers to phase out these toxins in products where the greatest exposure and harm can occur. These are products that go in the mouth, products that go on the skin and hair, and products that are intended for children under 3 years of age. Manufacturers can apply for a waiver if they show that children are not exposed to the chemicals in the product, or if there are no technically or economically feasible alternatives on the market. The point of the law is that if there are safer alternatives to toxic chemicals, large manufacturers should replace them, and we give them over 6 years to do so. So now a couple of the myths that were around before and continue to this day. Myth number one, the toxic-free kids law is not harmonized with similar laws in other states. The fact is Oregon's law is very similar to laws in other states, including Washington and Maine. You're right, Senator Olson, that California's is way larger, contains thousands of chemicals. The Oregon legislature worked incredibly hard with experts from other states to ensure that our law was harmonized in many important ways with other laws. Examples of our work to align Oregon's law can be found in our list of chemicals of high concern for children's health, which is identical to this point with Washington's list. The globalized product identification system used for disclosure, the presence of manufacturing control program provision, and the use of alternatives assessments to guide decisions about safer chemicals used in products, among others. Washington law actually does allow for them to require disclosure of internal components. This is something that you'll be hearing, that we are not the same. Our law, the Washington law, does allow for it. They decided not to look at internal components in 2011 because of fear they'd be deluged with data, but their law does allow them to do this, require this in the future. In the few cases where Oregon's law was not aligned with those other states, the differences reflect the need to address key loopholes and shortcomings in their laws. We also want to simplify our law and make it more practical for Oregon businesses, like our exemption for manufacturers with annual sales of under $5 million. We created these changes intentionally after much input and negotiation to create a program that's more effective at protecting kids while balancing the needs of businesses. Number two, myth number two, fees associated with the toxic-free kids law are too high. Fact, these fees are reasonable and necessary to protect taxpayers and ensure fiscal responsibility. The schedule of fees developed by OHA was developed with a robust rulemaking process with input from diverse stakeholders and experts. The fees established by the agency are reasonable and necessary to implement the law, including cases where it's necessary to hire external consultants with specific expertise not available to OHA. The fee reductions proposed under Senate Bill 836 would significantly impede OHA's ability to implement the law, forcing taxpayers to foot the bill for billion-dollar multinational corporations in the cases where outside expertise is needed. Myth number three, the legislature needs to review the toxic-free kids law before it's even implemented. Fact, OHA is required to report to the legislature on implementation progress. Why are we being asked to spend taxpayer dollars to review a program that hasn't even had a chance to work yet? This is something they asked before. The law's not yet into effect, and it's still on the table. We haven't even started to collect data on toxic chemicals in children's products, and now we're being asked to make changes. Let's not take a step backward by trying to fix something that isn't broken. When OHA reports to the legislature on implementation of the Toxic Free Kids Act in 2019, we'll have the opportunity to hear their recommendations for improvements. We already have a process for providing legislative oversight on this law. Myth number four. Oregon can't afford to protect children's health. Fact, the fiscal impact to Oregon taxpayers is mitigated by fees. The agency is working hard to make the best of limited resources and staff. In fact, in an effort to stretch limited resources even further, OHA successfully secured a grant from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to help build a data collection system. Our investment in the system reflects OHA's responsiveness to industry concerns about the challenge of reporting on their use of toxic chemicals in children's products. Myth number five, Oregon has the most complex and expensive law in the nation. Fact, laws in other states, including California and Vermont, are more comprehensive and complex than Oregon's in the number of chemicals that they require. The European Union's REACH program and California's Safer Consumer Products program cover far more products and chemicals than Oregon's law. Those laws and others like them are far more complex and expensive to implement than Oregon's Toxic Free Kids Act. Other states have recognized gaps in chemical policy and are taking actions to protect families. I have some examples here, but I'm going to skip over that in the interest of time. Myth number six, let the federal government do this work. This is an opinion now. I feel even stronger today than I have in the past that we cannot wait for the federal government to act. While TSCA was reformed in Congress after approximately 40 years after its passage, and after the passage of our bill, and perhaps in part due to it, our own bill and other states' bills, we cannot count on the federal government to take action to protect Oregon's children. Like Washington, Maine, Maryland, Minnesota, and California, we must act to protect the children in our state. So as you can see, the fact remains that Oregon has a practical but protective program in place. Let's continue to protect some of the most vulnerable among us by denying the kinds of rollbacks proposed in Senate Bill 836. So just a couple of things on the actual proposals that they have. First is increasing the de minimis level, Section 1.3A5, increasing the de minimis reporting level to 100 parts per million from the current levels would allow manufacturers to avoid reporting on toxic chemicals that they intentionally use in children's products. Making this change was discussed during the bill drafting process, but we decided not to make this change. Number two, exempting inaccessible components, Section 2.2. Making so-called physically inaccessible components exempt from regulation would create a major loophole in the current law by allowing manufacturers to circumvent regulatory scrutiny for toxic chemicals used in any part of a product that they claim is inaccessible without requiring them to prove it. Some chemicals, like flame retardants, can migrate from, quote, inaccessible components in furniture, like in children's mattresses, into household dust and then into kids' bodies. This has been shown by scientific studies. Flame retardants are scientifically linked to brain impacts in kids. Industry requested this change during the bill drafting process, but we decided not to make this change in order to protect kids from potential exposure. Three, requiring OHA to reanalyze data. This is Section 6.1. This is an attempt to mire OHA down in an unnecessary and redundant series of resource-wasting reviews that would have the effect of curtailing or eliminating regulation of toxic chemicals in children's products. The Oregon legislature and agencies, as well as legislatures and agencies in Washington, California, Minnesota, New York, and Vermont, have already reviewed the available scientific data, evaluated the federal policy context, and determined that toxic chemicals used in kids' products represent a threat to their health. In fact, the list of chemicals of concern to children's health included in the Oregon Toxic Free Kids Act was the same as the one used in Washington State under their Children's Safe Products Act. This is one example of many instances where Oregon legislators worked hard to create alignment between state programs. Four, requiring legislative and gubernatorial approval of law implementation, Section 6.4, forcing OHA to seek legislative and gubernatorial approval to implement arguably the most important and health protective parts of the law, i.e., removal of toxic chemicals from kids' products, is another attempt to prevent the agency from doing its job. It would delay implementation of the most critical piece of the law, which is to replace these harmful chemicals with those that are less harmful, and would waste thousands of taxpayer dollars. While I strongly oppose Senate Bill 836, I appreciate the opportunity to clarify intent on the issues brought forth in the bill. I hope for once and for all. If there is any chance of this bill going forward, I suggest we use it to change our current law in which we restrict the adding of new chemicals to merely five chemicals during every three-year review, which was part of the law passed and was part of the 2015 negotiations. I believe that we should align with the Washington law, which may be adding 21 chemicals to their list of chemicals of high concern to children. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for that thorough presentation.
I know there are others that are going to, and I am in a health committee, yeah. But I'm passionate about this. Happy to answer any questions.
Vice Chair Olson, you seem to be lying in wait.
Well, no, I'm not lying in wait. No. it's interesting because I've been involved with this for a long time also, but didn't ever have the privilege to sit in on these exclusive negotiations. So the one first question that I always asked when this original bill came forward was, why do we exclude companies that make less than $5 million a year? They can poison children just as well as the big companies.
Well, I actually started with the same perspective that you did, and this was just part of negotiations. Like, people who said this is going to be really hard on some of the smaller businesses, the idea was we were going to try to use market forces. So if some of the big ones were identifying chemicals of concern and the number of products that they were using, for instance, Target using Toulene in their underwear, they have such a big piece of the market, it would have so much more of an impact on kids. And if they had to report this, and they had to even start phasing it out, which is where we are stronger than the Washington law and more impactful, I would say, then the smaller groups would start following suit because they buy some of the same chemicals from some of the big companies. So that's really the most effective way of moving the market with doing the least amount of damage to smaller industries. If there were really a serious attempt to revise this bill and there was an appetite to do that, I would certainly be in favor of that, of making it apply to everyone.
Well, back in those days, I was always adamant about that because of the fact that that gave a cost advantage to the smaller companies because they wouldn't change, because they could buy things at a different rate and not have to provide the same scientific background as the larger companies, so they had an advantage.
Can I say,
are you looking forward to an implementation of this bill that we could move it forward if there was corrections?
I think the kind of corrections that I would see in the bill are probably different. They are not probably. They are very different from the ones that I see in 836. For instance, we kind of artificially kept ourselves to five, adding five bills. You can take off bills anytime if you find that they're really no longer in use and you want to keep your list to 66 and you want the ones that emerging research shows are the most harmful. And we know that other states like Washington are vigorously looking at this and they have a bigger budget than we do. So if they start adding ones to their list, we would want to add. But we artificially restricted ourselves to doing a revision of the list every 3 years with legislative oversight. And we artificially restricted ourselves to saying only five just because we wanted to kind of put our arms around it and keep it limited in some way. Washington actually does not have that particular restriction. So we very much aligned our bill with Washington, except for in some little minor ways here and there. But one of the differences is that they allow, I'm not sure if it's an unlimited number or if there's any kind of cap at all, but I know that right now they're looking at adding 21, and they're especially looking at flame retardants. That's a huge area of emerging research that shows how harmful those chemicals are and how, in fact, they do not do the kind of safeguarding against fire that we used to think. But I wanted to go back to your comment also on small companies. Again, I would agree with you, Senator, if that was one of the changes that we wanted to make was to include all companies. What Washington did was they said they had a tiered thing, and they said we're going to start with reporting from the really big companies that have revenues of over $1 billion, and then it was from, I think, like 500 million or 100 million to, I used to know this table very well, up to 1 billion. That was tier two. So the first reporting would have to be done by the really big ones, and then 2 years later by the second biggest in terms of revenue, and then they got it all the way down. And it was going to be several years out that they were actually going to have the really small companies do that were between zero and I think 10 million or something.
Sounds like we're getting taken over here. Just a follow-up question.
Yep.
Since you were involved in the original negotiations, and I was always curious about this, because Washington stated, their scientists stated that they were looking at these products, they had lists of the products as we did the same thing, but they clearly stated that these products weren't going to be that harmful. And they said, we will not eliminate them. We will allow them to stay in. We added the elimination of them. With OHA not having the technology to be able to know what chemicals to go to, you're allowing other companies to say, this is where we need to go. How did that come about, and why did we not just stick with Washington and follow? Because I think all the other states that you talked about did not eliminate chemicals and say you have to get rid of them. They all said, well, put them on the list, but...
Because we absolutely wanted to go farther. We wanted to be the front of the pack and say it's not just enough to identify which are harmful. We need to institute a process where once we know they're harmful, we need to start phasing them out. But we did a very reasonable phase out. The phase out was, first of all, we're going to, again, target, just like they had a tiered program starting with the biggest companies, we're going to target the phase out. They have to... It's a report on all of them, but we're going to target the phase out where the greatest potential harm can be done. So those are products that go in the mouth, like Binkies that go in the mouth. They're sucking all day long. Or they are products that go in the skin or the hair, like shampoo. So again, the amount of contact is huge. So any toxic chemical, it's not just, you know, you play with a toy, but it's on your skin. And then third, it's for kids under three. So that is where the scientists have identified that the greatest amount of exposure and harm could come from. So the idea of phasing it out is we allow them to phase it out with a waiver if they can show that these inaccessible parts, and this is one of the big things in this bill, it says we want to exclude inaccessible parts from reporting. But from reporting doesn't make sense. You can just report it, but if there's flame retardant in a mattress, you report it because, but later, if you can show that your inaccessible part, like maybe it's a piece of lead in a toy or something, there's no way that you can ever have exposure to the kid, then you can seek a waiver, an exemption for being able, from having to phase it out, which is the expensive part, is having to phase something out. And the phase out, as a reminder, is only happens when there's an alternative chemical that can be used for the same function and is less harmful. There's a waiver if you can show that it's inaccessible at that point. There's a waiver if you can say there's nothing else on the market that will provide that same soft flexibility for the rubber ducky and the, you know, the phthalates, that if there's no other way that you can make it soft, then you can still use that. You just have to report it. And there's also a waiver that says if this is economically unfeasible, you just absolutely can't do that, to be determined in rule, then you don't have to. So the gist of the bill was, if there's an alternative and it's economically feasible, then you need to phase it out in these very limited instances where the greatest impact can happen with kids because of in the mouth, on the skin or shampoo, or for kids under three. It was enormously reasonable, done over 5 years of work, and it's just in the rulemaking process. But a lot of the issues that were brought up over 5 years continue to come up. And when they didn't get into the bill that was passed in 2015, and then they didn't get adopted in the rulemaking process where there's a very strong industry stakeholder presence, they now end up here.
Okay. Thank you very much, Representative.
Thank you.
Really appreciate all of those clarifications.
And I'll be submitting my letter for the RAC that I sent in October, as well as a DOJ opinion, as well as my testimony for today, which had some things I skipped over in the interest of time.
Okay.
Thank you.
We know where to find you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay, so people, if you'll bear with me, I'm going to temporarily close the public hearing on this bill so that we can do a couple of work sessions. And to that end, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 847, which is the second of Roblin's work session bills for
Jeez.
Today. Boy, you owe us, Senator, or at least you owe me.
That's right.
Vice Chair Olson.
Chair Dimmer, I move Senate Bill 847 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Vice Chair Olson has moved Senate Bill 847 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Beth, could you remind us which bill is this?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 847 would authorize the State Land Board to identify and submit to the legislature a list of state trust lands with limited performance potential for transfer to another state agency, federal agency, or tribe. The bill was heard on March 20th. There is a fiscal impact statement and no revenue impact.
Okay. Colleagues, we had a good hearing on this last week. Is there any discussion of this bill?
Oh, I'm a yes. Are you a yes, Alan? Well, we got to have one no.
Do we?
Yes, we do.
I don't remember approving those bylaws for the committee. But, okay, I'm gonna. Well, I heard Senator Olson say that he was a yes. So, let it be noted. Okay. Is there any objection to the motion?
There's one objection.
Okay, Senator Bearchiger objects. So, with that exception, the motion passes, and it goes to Ways and Means. So I will close the work session on Senate Bill 847.
Need at least one no.
We
don't know we didn't.
And I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 745.
Is this another Roblin bill?
I'm afraid it is.
Oh.
Okay, thank you. This must be the Roblin rule.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're all good. Well, from
my
perspective.
How come we don't get donuts with these?
Chocolate
is coming.
Beth, could you tell us what this one is?
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 745 would direct transient lodging tax revenue collected by the Parks and Recreation Department for providing lodging at state recreation areas located along the ocean shore to a new ocean beach fund. The fund would be used to pay for expenses for managing state recreation areas along the ocean shore. There is a fiscal and a revenue statement on this bill and a subsequent referral to Senate Finance and Revenue.
Senator Dembrough?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 745 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Finance and Revenue by prior reference.
Senator Przanski has moved Senate Bill 745 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Finance and Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Olson.
I wholeheartedly agree with what you're talking about, but I've had so many of my constituents in the hotel motel business don't like to see grabbing of funds for specific entities, so I have to be a no on it. I'm sorry, Ernie.
That's good. I understand.
Great. Any further discussion? Okay.
You better take the roll.
Yeah. Why don't you just do the roll, Shelley?
Senator Mayor Sugar.
Yes, I get to vote on it again in finance.
Senator Przanski.
Aye.
Senator Roblin.
Aye.
Vice Chair Olson.
No.
Chair Dembrough.
Aye. Motion carries.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I think there must be a bylaw rule in here about the Roblin rule. I always have to have at least one no.
That's right.
It could be.
I'd like to get us all talking.
Okay. With that, I will close our work session on Senate Bill 745.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for accommodating my schedule today. I appreciate it.
Okay. I'm going to reopen the public hearing on Senate Bill 836. And I would call up Jennifer Gibbons, Al Kaufman, and Jeannie Deutsch, please.
Didn't know if it was important when that lady says, I just moved here from New Hampshire. Are you a Republican or Democrat? I said, I'm a Republican because you got my vote.
Speaking of vote, I'm going to vote.
Yeah. I said, I'm in committee.
Hey, whoever wants to go first, do it.
I will. Chair Dembrough and committee members, Jennifer Gibbons with the Toy Industry Association, thank you so much for the opportunity to comment today in support of Senate Bill 836. TIA is the nonprofit trade association for toy manufacturers, retailers, distributors, importers throughout North America. We have over 900 members, and our goal is manufacturing the sale of safe and compliant products. And since Senate Bill 478 passed in 2015, we have been working with the health authority in order to both identify and address compliance issues so that we can continue to sell product in Oregon and be compliant with this new law. TIA supports Senate Bill 836 because we have run into what we see as significant compliance challenges, one of those being that through the rulemaking process, the Oregon Health Authority was not able to exempt inaccessible components from reporting, as has been done under similar programs in both Washington State, Maine, and Vermont. It was previously mentioned that that decision in Washington State was made in 2011 in order to avoid an influx of data in the initial phases of that program. However, Washington State, in their 2017 rule update, is continuing to exclude inaccessible components from reporting. This is important for us as also federal and international standards would see little to no exposure risk to a child from inaccessible components. The second reason that we are here to support this bill is because not only does the rule establish a fee schedule for manufacturers who need to report to the Oregon Health Authority, but also for one of the waivers for manufacturing control programs. We are not seeking to change the fee schedule for reporting chemicals to the health authority. If people are reading that into the intent here, it is not, and we would be happy to make changes to ensure that the only thing that we're trying to do is to set more reasonable fees related to the manufacturing control program waivers. Those waivers are not even required to be submitted under the Washington State program, so this is, or Maine or Vermont. So this is a new waiver process for the industry, and it's our understanding that OHA has decided that these waivers will be reviewed by outside consultants. We're not sure who those outside consultants will be, how they'll be chosen, and why, you know, the $12,000 minimum was set, and why there's no cap established to how much can be charged in order to review these waivers. Additionally, we're here to support SB 36 because we would like to see a report back to the legislature, not that reanalyzes the data related to listed chemicals, but that analyzes the data that OHA will be collecting beginning in 2018. So we don't want to see the list reanalyzed. We simply want to see the data that they collect that's unique to Oregon analyzed before the third phase goes into effect. And at that time, the legislature could also look at the fiscal impact for the more costly and more complex phase of the law, which previously was not looked at in 2015. Senate Bill SB 836 does not repeal the current law, and OHA would still be charged with implementing several regulations that go beyond what other state laws do. Companies will still be required to report on the 66 list of chemicals to the Oregon Health Authority by December 31st of 2017, and OHA will still have the authority to add additional chemicals to that list, and product reports will still be made available to the public. And companies will still be paying higher fees in Oregon for compliance than we have to in other states. We did hear concerns related to the change in SB 836 regarding the definition of de minimis. That's certainly not one of our primary objectives or goals, and we would support amending the bill to address any concerns with that definition. So we urge you to consider moving this bill and keeping this conversation going. You know, we understand that there is concerns on the other side, and we would just ask for your support in keeping the conversation going. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Jennifer.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, and Senators. I'm Alan Kaufman. I'm with the Toy Association as well, where I fill the role of Senior Vice President of Technical Affairs. Among other things, I've got about 40 years of experience performing product safety for children's products, and I'm an appointed member of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Scientific Advisory Committee on Chemicals. In the interest of time, I'm going to limit my testimony to the inaccessible component issue. So in written testimony submitted to the committee, it's been suggested that substances in inaccessible components somehow magically move out of these components into the environment, and that's simply not true. There is no link between a chemical presence in a product and the presence in the environment, linking that to a particular children's product. And that's the missing link in all of these arguments that we've heard. So if you can't touch something and you can't put it in your mouth, how can you create an exposure? And that's why U.S. federal lawmakers, policymakers, and in the European Union, where the precautionary principle is utilized, they've spent a lot of time defining what accessible is, defining what mouthable is. It's not what we say it is. There are very specific definitions in the Code of Federal Regulations. There are very specific requirements in the European Union. And it is not only that something is inaccessible as it's received, but it also has to remain inaccessible after some fairly rigorous abuse testing of these products. We understand that children sometimes use products in ways that they're not intended. For instance, some products have to survive a drop test from 54 inches 10 times onto a vinyl-covered concrete floor. And the components have to remain inaccessible. That's part of the definition of what an inaccessible component is. So we feel very strongly that with those use and abuse requirements, that if something remains inaccessible, the child's not going to be exposed to any chemicals that might be there. A good example would be TBBPA in a printed circuit board. It's reactive with the epoxy or with the phenolic. It doesn't migrate out. It would have to migrate from the printed circuit board through the outer casing to create an exposure. So there's really no reason to be concerned about a child being exposed to any of those chemicals. And I guess at this juncture, it might be illustrative to talk about hazard versus risk. This is the original bill, speaks to presence of chemicals. It speaks to chemicals which are hazardous. And in colloquial speech, hazard and risk sometimes are used interchangeably. But in an engineering and scientific perspective, that's not the case. You have to have exposure of something that has an inherent hazard to create a risk. A good illustration that I can think of is if you have a great white shark, I mean, that's the hazard. If you're right next to it in the ocean, you have a risk. On the other hand, if there's a piece of glass separating you from that shark at an aquarium, then you have the same hazard, but you have no exposure and therefore no risk. And so that's a very important point as we start to talk about inaccessible components, to make sure that we're really focusing on what's important, which is making sure that children are protected. And make no mistake about it, these requirements for inaccessible components being reportable, chemicals and inaccessible components being reportable, is completely out of alignment with federal requirements. It's out of alignment with EU requirements. It's out of alignment with every other state. No other state requires reporting on inaccessible components. And the issue is that manufacturers are faced with a choice. If some of these materials are in inaccessible components, they can apply for a waiver. But at $12,000 per chemical per product, you can see how that quickly becomes a very expensive proposition. They can go ahead and report it, but in a few years down the road, they'll be required to either perform an expensive alternatives assessment, or they'll be required to eliminate that material from the product. And because the original bill focuses on chemical safety, what they may be faced with is a choice of either selling a product which doesn't contain that chemical and therefore may present another hazard. For instance, if you don't have a flame retardant in a product, if you have to substitute one plastic for another, you may create a mechanical hazard. You may be faced with a choice of either selling a product which is less safe or not selling in Oregon at all. So with that, I'll take questions.
Thank you. Let's hear from our third person.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Joni Deutsch, Executive Director for the Northwest for TechNet. On behalf of the member companies of TechNet, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate Bill 836. My organization represents a diverse set of technology companies with more than 2.5 million employees in the fields of information technology, internet media, venture capital, and green tech. We are strong proponents of public policy initiatives that promote continued innovation, economic growth, and job creation. Key to achieving these goals is a regulatory climate that is practical, based on strong scientific foundation, and is implemented in a consistent fashion. Senate Bill 836 is important to the technology industry because it helps put back on track a regulatory program that is overly broad, lacks clarity for those entities subject to its reporting requirements, and is inconsistent with similar regulatory programs around the country, including, as you heard, Washington State. The Oregon Health Authority's implementing regulations impose reporting requirements that are unique to Oregon, creating a costly and unnecessary burden. Senate Bill 836 seeks to create a more uniform regulatory program by exempting inaccessible components from the reporting requirements. And as you heard, this would align Oregon's law with similar laws in Washington, Maine, and Vermont without compromising product safety. International regulations and federal laws acknowledge that these inaccessible components pose little to no exposure risk. The bill would also help bring some much-needed clarity and certainty to OHA's implementation efforts. To date, manufacturers have not received guidance from the state on how to comply with the law, when the state's reporting database will be operational, or the amount companies may have to pay for OHA to review reporting exemption requests. Furthermore, it's become clear that the cost to implement the original law is much higher than was originally estimated. Senate Bill 836 establishes a reasonable and certain fee provision and creates much-needed legislative oversight so these implementation and cost issues can be adequately reviewed. Senate Bill 836 provides for regulatory certainty that is needed to foster continued innovation and economic growth, and for these reasons, TechNet urges you to support Senate Bill 836. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Next panel, Jessica Siegel, Candace Smith, and Dr. Joel Nigg, please. Jessica, you want to start us off?
Hi. Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, my name is Jessica Siegel. As an Oregonian, a mom, and a businesswoman, I am here to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 836. My family and I care about a healthy lifestyle. I learned quite early on about eating healthy and organic, and we try to buy products from companies that align with our health and environmental values. Over the years, we've become wary of companies claiming that their products are safe. Despite our best efforts as parents, we've learned that sometimes we've used products on ourselves and on our children that contain harmful ingredients. It's become increasingly difficult to trust that any products are safe. This lack of trust is what drew me to follow the important policy steps Oregon is taking to protect my children from toxic chemicals and products. I was beyond proud of our state when we passed the Toxic Free Kids Act in 2015, and I am deeply concerned by the ways that SB 836 would damage important parts of a law designed to protect children's health. In addition to being a mom, I am also an independent consultant and a business owner with a safer skincare company called Beauty Counter. Beauty Counter is a rapidly growing business dedicated to making safer, high-performing products. As a certified benefit corporation, we deliver on our mission through public education, offering safer products for the whole family, and by advocating for more health protective laws. Our market in Oregon is rapidly growing. I earn an income for my family by providing safer products, including those for children and babies, to Oregon families. I started this important work because I was drawn to a company that puts people's health as a top priority. My work is validated, knowing my kids get to see their mom doing something she believes in. My husband is more relaxed, not carrying the whole financial responsibility of this family. And I am a part of a meaningful social change while building a highly successful business. I am proud that I help people make healthier choices for themselves and their families. Parents across the state were thrilled when Oregon passed the Toxic Free Kids Act. As an independent business owner and a concerned parent, I oppose the damaging rollbacks of the Toxic Free Kids Act included in SB 836 for the following reasons. Eliminating protections created by the Toxic Free Kids Act would make it harder for parents to trust the safety of ingredients used in children's products in Oregon. SB 836 would waste taxpayers' dollars. The Oregon Health Authority has spent considerable amount of time working with stakeholders on the rulemaking process and evaluating the best available science. This bill would force our health agency to waste time and valuable resources discrediting the alternative facts presented by the chemical industry. SB 836 brings us backward rather than forward. As an Oregonian, we expect our legislators will stand up for protecting people, and particularly the most vulnerable among us. Do not dismantle a law designed to help protect our children and their health. There is an overwhelming support from parents across the state and companies like Beauty Counter for protecting the Toxic Free Kids Act and program. Thank you for your time and your leadership and for considering my perspective on such an important topic.
Thank you very much, Jessica. Candace?
Hello. Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, my name is Candace Smith, and I'm with Olema Cosmetics, Inc. It's a small Oregon-based cosmetics manufacturing company. I've taken time to travel to Salem today because I think it's important for you to hear directly from at least one Oregon business, not just industry lawyers and associations that claim to speak on our behalf. I'm also here today because I'm a mother, and like mothers all over Oregon, I'm urging you to maintain common sense protections for our kids. Please don't compromise on the health of our children. We oppose Senate Bill 836. Rolling back practical protections for families and children in Oregon is irresponsible. As a manufacturer that makes safer products that come in direct contact with the skin, we are diligent about screening ingredients for toxicity. We welcome regulations that help improve the safety of all personal care products, including cosmetics, and particularly laws like the Toxic Free Kids Act that provide protections for children. As a business that invests in identifying and using safer ingredients in our products, we think Oregon's approach is sound. If enacted, we believe SB 836 would undermine the scientific basis of the Toxic Free Kids Act and continue with status quo that places safer product manufacturers at a disadvantage. The rollbacks included in this bill would break the trust that parents and consumers have placed in Oregon to protect the health of their children from toxic chemicals used in products. Manufacturers seeking exemptions to our law should be required to provide proof. We think it's important that the Oregon Health Authority is able to make sure that manufacturers are actively working with their suppliers and factories to reduce and eliminate chemicals of high concern to children's health when they are present as contaminants. But SB 836 would appear to make it more difficult, if not impossible, for OHA to effectively implement this important provision. Reasonable fees provide support for businesses and protect kids. It is important that OHA has a schedule of fees that is sufficient to cover reasonable estimated costs, including levels of program staffing and external support necessary to protect kids and meet industry needs and expectations. Drastically reducing fees as proposed under SB 836 will undermine Oregon's ability to effectively implement the Toxic Free Kids Act and reduce the resources available to help businesses comply with the law. Oregon businesses need more certainty, not unnecessary bureaucracy. Under the new processes proposed in SB 836, businesses would have to wait even longer to know which chemicals will be regulated in which ways, creating new unnecessary requirements for OHA to seek redundant approvals from the legislature and governor to take action on toxic chemical harms Oregon businesses by delaying and limiting our ability to make decisions and investments. Thank you for the opportunity to testify and for your consideration of the perspective of an Oregon business. I appreciate your time and leadership on behalf of Oregon families and consumers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Candace. Dr. Nguyen.
Chairman Denbrough and committee members, thank you for letting me speak to you. My name is Joel Nigg. I'm a professor at Oregon Health and Sciences University in psychiatry and behavioral neuroscience. I am not representing OHSU today, although OHSU did support SB 478. I don't know their position on this current bill, and I'm speaking on my own behalf as a scientist. My research for the last 20-plus years has focused on the correlates and causes of child neurodevelopmental problems like ADHD, autism, and so on. And we look at both genetic and environmental factors in these disorders. So my particular concern is brain health in young children. And this is important because the brain is more sensitive than other organs. Some chemicals that may be unsafe in terms of cancer or safe in terms of cancer may be unsafe in terms of the brain. So I'm testifying in opposition to Senate Bill 836. I think the bill, I oppose it primarily because it departs from what I think is current scientific standards for what we need to be doing about protecting kids from toxic chemicals that are, especially those that are neurotoxic. I want to comment on the two main points that are coming up in the testimony today. The first is the de minimis rule. And here I echo the concerns that we should not have a different level there. The history of research in this area has been consistent in showing that the level of concern keeps going down the more we learn. We think a chemical is safe at this level, and then we find that it's not. And our research has been part of showing that. So we should not assume that because it seems safe today, it'll be safe tomorrow at a given level in a product or in a person's body. So it's important, I think, to report all detectable levels so we know what's in there and we can keep studying whether that level is safe or not. On the issue of accessibility, this has to be demonstrated. It can't be assumed. I understand that some demonstrations may be available. That's good. But they should still be reported, even if they're inaccessible, so that independent verification is possible. We can't study whether a chemical is leaching from a product if we don't know it's there. We can't try every product just to see what's in there. So they should be reported so that independent peer review is possible of claims of inaccessibility. This is how science works. We have to have peer review. We have to have independent verification. You take that away if you allow some things not to be noted or mentioned in the reporting. So I'm a strong supporter of requiring everything to be reported, even if it's inaccessible or thought to be inaccessible, so that can be verified and so evidence can be accumulated over time. Again, what science shows today, it might show something different tomorrow. We have to be able to allow the science to progress and to track what it's doing. We can't do that without information. So overall, I think the Toxic Free Kids Act should be given time to work. It's only really doing minimal compared to the science. I included in my written testimony a citation for you of a consensus statement from 50 experts published just a few months ago, and in it calls for much stronger measures than we're doing even in Oregon. So my own opinion based on the scientific review is that the innovations Oregon has introduced from other states are actually getting closer to where the science recommendations are, not further from it. That article I showed you and I gave you a quote in the written testimony calls for not just reporting but phase out of these chemicals as Oregon is allowing. So I don't think we're departing from the science with these rules that we have. Thank you very much, and please keep up your good work.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dr. Nee. Any questions for anyone on this panel? Okay, thank you all very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, let's have Andy Hackman, Elizabeth Remley, and is Amanda here, or Kylie, are you coming up? Amanda Dalton.
Go for it. Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Dembrough and members of the Committee on Environment and Natural Resources. My name is Andy Hackman, here on behalf of the Juvenile Product Manufacturers Association. We are the national trade association that represents the manufacturers and distributors over 95% of the juvenile products sold here in the United States, from cribs to strollers to baby bottles and those types of products are the bandwidth of products that we represent. I've provided written copies of my testimony. It's late in the afternoon, so I won't speak to those specifically. I do want to highlight some of the key points and try not to re-go over points that have already been made, but to clarify sort of our perspective on why this legislation is so necessary. Safety is the number one priority of the companies that interact in this space and create products. You don't get into the juvenile products industry trying to make an unsafe product. You get into this industry because you see a need with children that you raise or children that you interact with, and you're helping to meet that need, whether it be safe mattresses, safe cribs, new strollers that help protect children better. That's what motivates companies to create products in this space, and I think that's something that's important to understand as we try to look at the regulations that are in place and are going to be a significant challenge for feasibility. I don't want to relitigate all of the original premise of the legislation. That's not what we believe Senate Bill 836 does. It addresses some key issues around feasibility of the existing statute and the regulations with regard to consistency with other states. As mentioned, Washington State was first here. I either fortunately or unfortunately for myself have been involved in the development of these programs from state to state for quite a long time. And when they implemented their program in 2008, folks weren't happy on both sides of the aisle, which normally means that something is potentially fair and right. It's a program that has demonstrated results in terms of providing consumers greater information. And with regard to inaccessible components, it struck a balance and a compromise, based not off of just their assumptions on exposure, but based upon the standard of reasonable and foreseeable use and abuse, which comes from the Consumer Product Safety Commission, as they look at a product being designed specifically to withstand a real-world situation and exposure to the materials that are inside, whether or not they're hazardous or not, because they're thinking about small parts and choking hazards as well as exposure to the chemicals that might exist in a circuit board or something else that's contained inside of the product. So it's a standard that's validated not just by the companies but validated by the Consumer Product Safety Commission. I think that's something that's important for us to recognize as well. With regard to fees, another big element of this legislation, we're not opposing fees, and we're not trying to roll back fees on general reporting. Fees exist in Vermont, fees exist in Maine, and fees would exist here in Oregon under the program. We are specifically looking at the outside fees to consultants, which would start at $12,000 for a small or medium-sized company and go up from there in $12,000 increments. We're trying to get some parity in those fees so that if there's going to be an alternatives assessment done or an exemption waiver reviewed, that it's done in a way that there's an incentive to do it effectively, not for consultants to create many businesses off of the fact that we have a program in this state that allows $12,000 per time, per review, and per assessment. And finally, with regard to having the legislature review bans, as mentioned by the good representative that brought this legislation forward, TSCA, or the Toxic Substance Control Act, was reformed since this law passed. We think it's important that the legislature understand if we're going to continue forward with the automatic bans in this legislation, and again, this does not roll those back. It just simply asks for the Oregon Health Authority to come back to the legislature and help us understand the impacts of those potential bans and if they might conflict with federal law. Now that EPA is moving forward with a more robust Toxic Substance Control Act, they've identified 10 chemicals already, and in July are going to begin doing risk assessments on those chemicals. We think it's important that we all collectively understand and look at the data before the automatic bans roll into place, and this legislation would look to do that. And finally, I just want to say, as a father myself of an 8-year-old little girl, this is an industry, and the changes that we're trying to make are hopefully making this program a legacy that we can all be proud of. Our companies want to comply with the law. They're complying in Washington, Vermont, and Maine, and we need the ability to have some consistency to allow decisions to be made in a coordinated manner and so that states can learn from each other. If we continue to have divergences because we want to go farther or have a slight difference here, the ability for us to share information from state to state and to learn and to continue to protect our kids and be in proactive compliance with the statutes, that's jeopardized if we don't take a serious look at making some of the changes that this legislation proposes to do. So I appreciate the opportunity and appreciate your time this afternoon.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
Chair Dembrough and members of the committee, Elizabeth Remley here today on behalf of the Consumer Technology Association. You have a letter from the Consumer Technology Association, so I will just be very brief. CTA supports Senate Bill 836, specifically Section 2, which excludes inaccessible components. In following with other states with similar laws, Oregon's law should distinguish between inaccessible components that do not come into contact with children and therefore do not pose a safety threat. Consumer Technology Association represents nationally many manufacturers of consumer electronics and related products. And Senate Bill 478, when it passed in 2015, specifically excluded consumer electronics from the definition of children's products. They also manufacture many of the inaccessible components we're discussing, which are not excluded under the rules promulgated by OHA. We think that's relatively inconsistent with the original bill, and we also would point out that it's inconsistent with what's going on in the other states. It makes it really difficult for the manufacturers of these products to be consistent in complying with the laws across the four states. So we urge your support of Senate Bill 36, specifically Section 2, that would exclude inaccessible components, as we think that that represents the original intent of Senate Bill 478, as well as the laws in the other states. Thanks.
Thank you. Questions? Elizabeth, I have one. So, you know, in terms of, as an example of the inaccessible component you're thinking of, something that has a microchip that's inside a stuffed animal, would that be considered inaccessible?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, I think it depends on where it is. I mean, I think there is a really good chance that that would be considered an inaccessible component under the law.
Because kids can get inside those things, you know, they get very aggressive sometimes.
Chair Dembrough, so does my dog with their toys.
Right.
Squeakers die. So I think, though, that there is a pretty stringent definition of inaccessible components. And again, as we're looking at consistency across the states and making sure that we know what we're complying with, I think it's important to move forward with that.
Okay, thank you. Yes, Vice Chair.
Thank you. Regarding inaccessible components, assuming that these toys are battery operated and batteries are excluded, I find that interesting that we're concerned about the component of the makeup of the component, but we're not concerned about the battery, which is extremely toxic, especially if they get old and they leach. But they're excluded in this issue, so I just wanted to bring that out. And then as regarding the fees, could you explain how that fee structure was set up? Because it seems rather fundamental that some tests would be very reasonable and easy to do and cheap, and others would be very difficult. And I wonder just how they came upon the $12,000 number as the good number.
Chair Dembrough, Senator Olson, In terms of the fees, they escalate as you get farther into the program. There's an initial fee for reporting that's $250. That's somewhat in parity to Vermont, which has a fee for similar reporting. In Maine, the fee is based upon case by case. They've only designated five chemicals technically, three classes of chemicals that require reporting in Maine. And the fee is stipulated in each one of the rules when they require reporting. With regard to the $12,000 fee, my understanding is it was just an approximate estimate when the Oregon Health Authority talked to some consultants in this area that obviously hopefully have experience in trying to do some of these assessments. But what I stress to the committee is that when you get into this area of expertise, it's very unique. And it's the expertise that's largely within the companies as they develop those products. So every other state does not require submission of manufacturing control programs or inaccessibility assessments, in part because the state doesn't have the experience to evaluate those. We're not saying here we're unwilling to submit that information. We're willing to do that. The state will get more information than any other state in the country. This bill simply proposes to say we're not going to give $12,000 open-endedly in $12,000 increments until a consultant decides that they've developed the experience necessary for this particular product to make a determination. So I think that's at the heart of what the challenge here is having at least in a reasonable fee to start off with as we venture into a new area, not roll back fees, but at least start from a basis of we're going to start here with a reasonable fee as we develop some expertise in this area, not simply, I hate to say, create a cottage industry around these $12,000 assessments that, pardon the phrase, but there might be some self-interest in a consultant to continue to work. I mean, being a consultant myself.
You sympathize.
I can understand how it could be seen as a nice retirement option. Sorry.
Thank you. Any other questions?
One follow-up. Yeah. And my presumption is you don't think these fees are reasonable for the amount of information you're getting back.
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, the $12,000 fee is really at the heart of what the amendment or what the changes looks at. We're not trying to change the base reporting fees. We understand the department has to establish a database. Other states have done that. I mean, we would suggest that Washington State has done a lot of work in this area. There could be potentially no fee if you use their database and made the system consistent. However, we understand that the statute allows initial reporting fees, and we're not opposing those.
And if you may, one more. On the de minimis issue, do you feel that if the bill allowed it to change to 100 parts per million, that you would be able to slide chemicals underneath there?
Chair Dembro, Senator Olson, I think as alluded to earlier, 100 ppm was a number that was picked in Washington State to try to compromise, again, between different perspectives. A PQL, which is what is now in statute and used in some other states, looks at what we're intentionally adding, as I think was referenced. Some of the PQLs might be over 100. Some might be slightly below. I think there's certainly a willingness from industry to work on that language because I think there is perhaps some concern from others that we are trying to slip chemicals under that level, and that certainly is not the intent. So if we can clarify and tighten that language up, I think there's a commitment to do that.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both. Mr. Ackman, thank you for coming. Okay, Angela Crowley-Cook and Cindy Robert, please. And then there'll be one more panel after them.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert. I'm here today on behalf of Metro in opposition to Senate Bill 836. I'll be very brief. We do have written testimony on the record. Metro Council strongly supported Senate Bill 478 in 2015, and our staff was also actively involved in the rulemaking that went on. One of the concerns we have is that many of the things that this bill, Senate Bill 836, addresses were discussed during the rulemaking process, and by putting forward this bill, we're unnecessarily supplanting the results of those well-reasoned discussions.
Thank you, Cindy. Angela.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, members of the committee. My name is Angela Crowley Cook. I'm the legislative director of Oregon Environmental Council. Oregon Environmental Council strongly opposes Senate Bill 836, which would create loopholes in the current law. The bill would significantly weaken the important protections that the law has established. The provisions, as has been said before, are issues that the industry groups have been working on for years, both in the bill drafting process and negotiations and, of course, in the rulemaking. And these provisions were considered very thoroughly. There were bipartisan sponsorship of the bill. We considered them, and they were not accepted during the bill drafting process nor in the rulemaking. Speaking of the rulemaking, so the Oregon Health Authority has really conducted a very strong and thorough rulemaking process, even beyond the folks that were invited to sit at the Rules Advisory Committee. There were additional industry groups that wanted to attend, and they were allowed. There was kind of an open invitation. I guess my side was pretty outnumbered, but that's fine. Everyone got a chance to really speak their mind and get all the issues out on the table. These issues were all discussed, but in the end, the Oregon Health Authority is using the best available science to develop the regulations, and so that's why they ultimately did not decide to accept any of these changes. In fact, the Oregon Department of Justice weighed in with legal opinions and attended the Rules Advisory Committee to ensure that the intent of legislators was fully carried out. So I just want to briefly touch on some of the issues that we've been discussing today. So first on increasing the de minimis level, this would create a loophole in the bill, in the reporting law, allowing some of these toxic chemicals to not be reported and then not be phased out. If they're not reported, they don't have to comply with the phase out piece. But there is a scientific reason for the way that the law was structured. It is not uncommon for substances to be restricted at levels far below 100 parts per million. For example, the FDA limit for mercury in cosmetics is 1 part per million. The FDA limits the presence of vinyl chloride in food packaging to between 5 and 50 parts per million. So just allowing that exemption level of 100 parts per million for all chemicals, it just doesn't make scientific sense. In addition, the provisions in the bill actually are very different from what's in Washington State and would weaken the law from even what they have in Washington. So it would actually bring us even more out of alignment. On the second issue about inaccessible components, during the rulemaking process, there was a lot of conversation about this particular piece. The stakeholders around the table were asked to provide an example of an inaccessible component that was proven not to leach out chemicals, and the industry groups could not come up with an example at that time. And actually, as we heard earlier during some testimony about this, kind of a discussion about things magically migrating out of products, well, as we all know, magic tricks, you can always find out how they're done. And so I have some studies here. The first one is about the migration of organophosphorus flame retardants from closed cell form into dust. That's a 2016 study. It's up on the EPA's website. And so it has been proven that toxic flame retardants move out of products into dust. Then the next piece of the magic trick is that another study, this one's in Environmental Science and Technology, urinary biomonitoring of phosphate flame retardants, levels in California adults and recommendations for future studies. This is in 2014. And so they showed that the flame retardants found in dust are then found in the urine of those adults, and they are correlated with the levels. And then last study, temporal trends in exposure to organophosphate flame retardants in the United States. This is a 2017 study in the Environmental Science and Technology. So it's been shown that actually during the past decade, the use of these toxic flame retardants has increased, and then human exposure has increased, and the finding of the flame retardants in our body has also increased. So there isn't a magic trick here. We know it's happening. It's been proven through a number of studies. lastly, on the inaccessible components piece, so one of the original bill sponsors was Representative Jason Conger, and he made sure that we had a provision in the bill that would say if the company could prove that there was no exposure to the chemical from the product, they would receive a waiver. So this issue has already been addressed in the law, and that was, you know, debated. We didn't love that part, but it made it into the law, and so there it is today. If the children really are not exposed, there's a way for that company to get a waiver. Third, talking about the fees for the manufacturing control program. So this was something that did end up in the law, this exemption for manufacturing control programs. The idea here is if you're a company that already has a program to try and reduce the number of contaminants, the level of contaminants in the products, if you have a rigorous program, you can have an exemption from the reporting. Now, if you have an exemption from the reporting, you also get an exemption for the phase out. So basically, if you apply for this exemption, you're exempt from the whole law. Now, it's hard for the Oregon Health Authority to determine, is this manufacturing control program, does it really exist? Is it rigorous enough? Are they actually working to reduce contaminants, or is this kind of a paper exercise here? And so as you heard from the Oregon Health Authority, they need those increased fees in order to have the experts determine, is this actually a program? Are they actually working to reduce contaminants? And so while we assume good intentions on the part of the companies that apply for the exemption, if we don't have enough funding to truly verify and review those programs, it could allow bad actors to falsely claim the exemption. And I would assume it would be in the interest of folks that want to claim that exemption to make sure that companies are truly complying and that there is rigorous oversight so that there isn't fraud in this exemption so they can continue to use it. Next, talking about requiring the Oregon Health Authority to reanalyze data. So as other folks have mentioned, other states have already done this work. The law was drafted intentionally not to recreate the wheel. We want to use the work that other states have done. This provision would create unnecessary delay, and as other folks had mentioned, it sounds like it'd be a pretty high fiscal impact for that section. Lastly, the piece about requiring legislative approval of the law. Again, this would have a pretty large fiscal impact on creating a whole new committee to review the work. I guess at this point I would remind the committee that not only was the bill bipartisan when it was put together, it was passed into law in a bipartisan way. All of these issues were debated and discussed. It's been through the legislative process since 2012. So I think it's been thoroughly vetted by the legislature. I don't know that we need to spend any more taxpayer dollars reviewing it. Before I step away, I wanted to address some of the issues that were brought up in previous testimony. First of all, Senator Olson asked if other programs eliminate chemicals. There are other states that also eliminate chemicals, have a phase out. California being the strongest, not only do they have a phase out piece, but there's also a life cycle analysis included, which is far stronger than what we have here in Oregon. Maine also requires the phase out of chemicals in some products. Others had mentioned the federal law, the Toxic Substance Control Act, that was reformed. However, I'm not very confident that that will actually be followed through. The latest budget that came out of our new administration had severe cuts in the EPA. So I'm not really hopeful that TSCA will be fully implemented as intended. And then we heard a little bit about reviewing of the data before moving forward. So another reason why this is unnecessary to have the Oregon Health Authority do that is because we've had reports from Washington on the same list of chemicals for years. We don't need to wait for any new data. We have Washington's data. We know that those chemicals, their exposure is there. And when Washington has found that some of these chemicals aren't really a problem, they've taken them off the list. So there's no need to recreate the wheel on this once again. And I think that's it. I'll conclude there. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Angela. Any questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you both very much. Okay, our last panel, Mike Pries and Jeffrey Temple, please. Mr. Temple.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeffrey Temple. I am the director for marketing and public affairs for Fred Meyer and QFC. Fred Meyer has, for the record, rather, Fred Meyer has 52 stores in the state of Oregon, which employs 14,507 associates. Total Oregon employees, including store and non-store locations, is 15,720 associates. I'm here today on behalf of Fred Meyer supporting Senate Bill 836 as it brings the reporting process closer to what we must comply with in Washington State. The more our reporting costs square with other states, the less expensive, less complicated, and more consistent our reports are. The more consistent the reporting process is, the less it costs us an unnecessary duplication, thus reducing the impact on our retail pricing, which, of course, benefits our customers. This bill does not repeal the Toxic Free Kids Act, but does provide consistency and will help reduce internal costs for the retail community. Thank you.
Thank you. Chair Debro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mike Fries. I'm here on behalf of Associated Oregon Industries and the Oregon Business Association. I've submitted written testimony for the record, and it's kind of lengthy, so I'll try to keep my remarks brief, and I think you've heard most of what we have to say, but there are a number of points that I think are worth mentioning. First, consumer products safety, especially for children, is incredibly important for our members and those that have been following this particular rulemaking closely. And it's not just manufacturers, it's the retailers as well, who have internal processes that they have chosen to partake in to make sure that the products that they put on their store shelves are in fact safe. For those of you that didn't have the fortune of sitting through a year's worth of rulemaking with the Oregon Health Authority, there are some really important points that I think need to be addressed. That what we're trying to do is have that conversation in this bill. First, as you've heard, the bill or the rules and the statute do not directly align with other states. And have created some inconsistencies that are problematic for our members. One of those, of course, as you've heard, is the inaccessible component definition. We worked with the agency and the Department of Justice to try to align Oregon's definitions with those of Washington. After a number letters back and forth with the Department of Justice, at the last hour, they told the agency that they could not exclude inaccessible components based on statutory language. That's what we're here to address so that the agency can, or at a minimum, we should be able to have that conversation, which we weren't able to have a product safety or consumer safety discussion because of the statutory language. Second, the manufacturing control program. This was an important part, as one of the previous witnesses discussed, about what manufacturers got in the bill as part of the negotiations. What's really unfortunate is the fee schedule that the agency adopted in their rulemaking, which essentially, in many cases, guts that forum access. From many of the manufacturers. The fee schedule is so significant and so problematic with no cost constraints on the agency or the MCP applicant that it's hard to know what the total cost will be. And most companies that I've talked to that found that particular piece of the legislation helpful said that they will not even be able to participate in that program. So in Senate Bill 836, we look to take care of that particular piece of the fee schedule that that the agency was unwilling to listen to us. Lastly, on the fiscal impact, in my written testimony, there's some more detail. But what the agency had told us and our members, including some of those that that may have supported the bill or were neutral on the bill, that this would be primarily general funded.
The agency has flipped that more recently and added FTE from their original projections, and without really any explanation as to why their previous estimates were off and why they think that the program needs to grow. And this is before the most controversial, most complicated piece of the bill comes in. So in order to make sure that the agency has the proper oversight and budget authority, we would like to see the legislature take another look at what the agency can bring forward on the phase out. And to my last point is actually one I was testifying in another committee in front of Senator Brzezinski on regulatory reform, and I think it does bring up this important point of the legislature can amend rules by providing more direction in statute. And that's what we're asking for. We think that these provisions do not roll back the entire program, but make them more effective for our retailers and manufacturers here in Oregon. So with that, I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for that. Any questions, colleagues?
No, thanks.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you both. Thanks for coming down, Mr. Temple.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, is there anyone else that wanted to address this bill? Please say no. Okay, with that, I'm going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 836. Colleagues, we have a lot of material in our meeting materials box on OLIS to look at, and we'll look at all that and weigh next steps.
More coming, too.
Yeah. All right, so with that, I'm going to – did I close the public hearing? Well, I'll close it if I didn't. And open our last public hearing, which is on Senate Bill 634. And I'll ask Senator Knope to come up. And while he's doing that, Beth, could you tell us what this bill does?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 634 would add woody biomass to the list of qualifying green energy technologies that may be used to satisfy the requirement that 1.5% of the total contract price to construct or renovate a public building is spent on a green energy technology.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, State Senator Tim Knope, Senate District 27, which includes Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. I once again make my biennial trek to the committee to work on my woody biomass bill. This is Senate Bill 634. The furthest I've gotten with this is I've actually passed it through the Senate 29-1, and typically dies in the House, but maybe this year will be different. Basically, what the bill does is it, the state requires a 1.5% investment in green energy for public buildings and major renovations, and Senate Bill 634 adds woody biomass to the list of green energy technologies that can that must be included in constructing and reconstructing or renovating public buildings. Woody biomass is green technology, is a byproduct of management and reforestation and other forest debris, including limbs, needles, branches, bark, sawdust, and other woody parts. But maybe you've heard me say that before. Including woody biomass in the green energy technology builds a new market for forest restoration byproducts and supports forest management and creates jobs for Oregonians. Wood is the largest biomass energy source. Including woody biomass in the green energy technologies would help rural communities by creating a market for resources available within their communities, bringing jobs to rural Oregon, and keeps energy dollars in our local economy. The bill would also help reduce CO2 emissions, encouraging management by thinning overgrown forests and clearing of woody waste from logging and other management activities, clearing fuel loads from forests, and helping prevent catastrophic fires. Including woody biomass in the allowable green energy resource creates more equitable use of renewable energies. With 48% of Oregon's landmass being covered by forests, rural communities would benefit greatly from the use of woody biomass as an energy source. Per the Department of Energy, Oregon has 17 woody biomass power facilities, primarily in the wood products industry. An additional 21 facilities in Oregon use woody biomass to provide space heat. These include schools and hospitals. This investment has allowed for more resources to stay in local communities and has provided a low-cost green energy for heating sources. Colleagues, I would encourage your support of this bill. I think really what I'm trying to do is to give communities more options as it relates to spending the 1.5% on green energy. And solar is a good option, but it may not always be the best option for a community that has a source for woody biomass, which is renewable. And so I would just encourage you to consider expanding the options, the menu of options a little bit, to allow communities to choose which one works best for them. And with that, I would be happy to answer any questions I can.
Okay. Any questions for the senator? He's right. We have seen this before.
Yeah. We've passed it before.
Yes. The Senate has passed it.
So. Deja vu.
Thank you for bringing it
Thank
again.
Thank you.
But let's hear some more about why we should pass it again. We have two panels worth of people to speak to us. So let's start with Tony DeBone, because he drove that distance. Let's have Bob Surek, sorry, and Dylan Cruz. Want to come up?
Sure. Yep. Senator Dembrough, members of the committee. My name is Tony DeBone, Deschutes County Commissioner. And like the senator said, it's like a biannual trip here. So I've been a commissioner for a few years, and I've been supportive of this for a few times. Deschutes County has many public and private acres of forest from the crest of the Cascade Mountains to the Deschutes River and beyond. Federally sponsored forest collaborative work has been diligently defining a prescription for the forest to reduce the effects of catastrophic forest fire. Biomass being regrown every day in the forest in central Oregon and around the state and can be managed to the benefit of energy production. My understanding is this initial 1.5% requirement was put in by the solar industry, but the biomass may be a great option also. New government construction in some parts of the state have different priorities than solar and geothermal is also in there. Biomass BTUs for heating in the winter are very different than electricity generated by solar on the sunny days and then converted to heat and light. Battery storage and electric distribution of solar will not cover those large BTU needs. Burning renewable chips, pellets, or other biomass is a lot shorter and younger carbon cycle than ancient oil and coal. In the city of Bend, Oregon State University Cascades branch is doing research on a campus-wide biomass heating system. That would be new government construction. Our Central Oregon Intergovernmental Council, the Council of Governments for Crook, Jefferson, and Deschutes County, has been working, has a work group and has been working for many years to pencil out public and private projects in Central Oregon. I ask you to consider supporting Senate Bill 634. Thank you so much.
Dylan?
Chair Dembrough, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dylan Cruz. I'm the policy director at Sustainable Northwest. I am also on the board of the Biomass Thermal Energy Council. Thanks for the opportunity to speak today. Thank you again for the hearing on this bill, and thanks to members of this committee that may have voted for it last time it passed out of the Senate. Senator Canope and Commissioner DeBone did a great job of kind of outlining the benefits of this bill. I just want to add a little bit of nuance to talk about it in the context of what it means particularly for rural communities and forest-dependent communities. Because, you know, we mentioned the 2021 biomass thermal facilities across the state of Oregon. Those are predominantly in non-natural gas territory. They're in rural communities, and they're predominantly public institutions. Schools, hospitals, facilities with a large high heat load that will be around for a long time. And so when we think about their heating source, it's especially important that they're maximizing their cost savings. And in those communities, because they're outside of gas territory, they're often forced to use expensive and volatile fossil fuel options, propane, fuel oil, diesel, even in some cases. They have very old, outdated systems that are very efficient, and biomass is a great option in these communities that have a tradition of wood products utilization. They're producing pellets. They're involved in working forest management. They may have chips as well. So we get these stewardship benefits. We get cost savings. We get carbon emissions reductions, and it's unique to these communities that have this opportunity. This bill is strictly about parity. There's no fiscal associated with it. Again, it's about tiering the resource to the appropriate technology. Some places that might be solar, in some places that might be geothermal, and in some places it could be biomass. It's all about competition in the energy sector, parity in our renewable energy policy, and giving these communities and public facilities the most options possible. Thank you.
Chairman Denbrough, Senators, my name is Bob Sorek. This is the first time I've been to this. It sounds like everybody else has done this a few times. But I'm not new to the industry. I started Bear Mountain Forest Products in 1988. And since that time, I've been very active in the biomass fuels industry. I've grown a company that now employs 50 employees in Oregon. We have a plant in Cascade Locks and one in Brownsville. And I've traveled across the country and across Europe to look at the technology and what's available. I'm part of the Biomass Thermal Energy Council. I'm one of the founders on the board. Pellet Fuels Institute, I'm on the board there. And also in Oregon, I was part of the governor's task force on biomass, as well as the DEQ wood smoke working group. So and I'm a forester as well. I worked in the Forest Service for 9 years before I started my company. So I've seen this industry from one end to the other. And there's a lot of good reasons to pass this. I'm in favor of it. And I won't go over all the things that Dylan has said and others. But there's a couple of aspects of it that I don't think have been brought up or haven't been explained in a lot of what I've seen. One of them is the fact that biomass, it's a big umbrella to put in, a big umbrella to cover all of the different things that are growing in the woods, growing in the different cities. And we've, like it or not, biomass is growing. It's going to be growing. It always has been growing. And we've noticed or we've handled it in the cities by collecting it and putting it into compost. And so people realize that it's going to be growing. It's going to keep growing. We don't do that. We have a hard time seeing that in the woods, but biomass is growing. It's woody biomass in the woods. And if we don't do something with it, it's going to either burn very, very catastrophically. We're going to burn it as slash in the woods, or it's going to decompose. And all of those different ways that we get rid of it or it goes away are more damaging to the environment and less useful than using it in modern wood heating appliances. And when I started the pellet company that I did, it was back when it was just pellet stoves, and they were compared with like the old earth stove or some of the old black boxes. And a lot of times people equate biomass right now with those old black boxes, but that's so far from the truth right now. And the reason is that these new units, these new appliances, are able to burn the fuel in just the right amount of fuel ratio for a 16-to-1 air to fuel ratio, so that it burns completely. Back in the day when you had a wood stove, you jammed it full of wood, cranked down the combustion air to slow the temperature down and control the combustion. We got incomplete combustion, emissions coming out that were smoky and full of volatiles. Now, with the pellet stoves and with the new modern heating devices that burn pellets or chips, you can monitor the amount of fuel going into the appliance so that you don't have to cut down the combustion air to make it burn slowly. You can just slow down the fuel, give it all the combustion air it needs, so you have a very clean burn. And it's that's one of the basic differences when people think about wood stoves. And we, on the wood smoke working group, that was the big issue. People thought wood burning is dirty. So far from the truth. And it's been shown in all across Austria, Sweden, Denmark. They're all putting these units in. And they can be, one of the last things I want to say is, they can be integrated with solar collectors as well. When the sun's shining, the solar heating collectors can collect the heat. But then when the sun's not shining, the pellet stove or the chip burner turns on. So it's not an either-or pellets or either-or biomass or thermal solar. It can be integrated together. So for those reasons, I think it's a good idea to pass the legislation. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob. Questions, colleagues? Yes, again, I'm very supportive of this. And its most logical application is to public buildings, schools, et cetera, that are near where the woody biomass is coming from, right?
Chair Denbrough, members of the committee, that's correct. Pellets can be transported a fair distance and still make these projects cost-effective, but obviously transportation has an impact on it. But they can go fairly far, 75, 100 miles in some cases, and still manage to provide fuel to these facilities. So we do have good transportation infrastructure in place and distribution across the state.
Just for, I guess, commentary,
in my travels to Oak Ridge for the elementary schools, we had an event up there this last Friday, and we did a thing in the gym, and then afterwards the superintendent took me over to show me the wood pellet stove boiler they have, and it's very, very impressive. And they've actually significantly cut their cost, and you're right. You know, the closer you can have the fuel to it, the better it is, but they're making it work well.
Great. Okay, Commissioner, I hope this isn't the last time you come to the Capitol, but I do hope it's the last time you come on this issue.
Thank you very much. And just one note, I was coming down from a bend after a board meeting this morning, and the slowest vehicle I was behind was a chip truck that was just moseying down the road, but it must have been full.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you all very much.
Thanks.
Okay, our last panel, Bill Kluding and Megan Nuss, please.
Hi, members of the committee. My name's Megan Nuss. I'm the project development manager for a company called Wisewood Energy. We are a Portland-based firm that designs and develops what we refer to as community-scale biomass energy projects. Most of our projects are biomass heating, boilers that provide heat to buildings. We do a small amount of small-scale combined heat and power with some power production. We work across the West in Washington, Oregon, California, Idaho, Colorado, and Alaska. And our clients include municipalities, school districts, tribal entities, and other private entities. Just to give you a sense, it sounds like you're all familiar with these kind of projects and systems. We do boilers in schools, hospitals, airports. We're starting to do more process heat applications for slightly larger users, for example, in the food industry. And we're also putting in more district heating systems and developing those projects that provide heat to multiple buildings from one boiler. For example, last year we turned on a facility in Burns, Oregon that's heating the elementary school, the courthouse, and a mental health facility using a hog fuel wood chip system with potential to expand. And that project is a neat example because the community has actually formed a cooperative so that they can take over ownership and have long-term local ownership for operations. One of the key parts of projects that we develop is to really help our clients understand what is a system that would work best for their circumstances and their resources, how to best integrate their objectives into the design that we're developing, and really what is appropriate for their available resources. And that's one of the reasons that we strongly support this bill. Because we see it as really putting more power and control into the hands of the communities so that they can look at the suite of technologies that are available and be supported to really determine what makes the most sense for them. It's been said before, and it seems you're familiar with this bill, but it really is about parity and giving the communities the option to find the most appropriate technology. And secondly, we actually don't compete that much with solar and wind, and that's because we mostly do heating projects. And as it has been mentioned, that's a pretty important difference when we're looking at these different renewable energy technologies. Wisewood Energy itself is an all-hands approach when it comes to renewable energy technology advancement and supporting these industries. But when it comes to what's appropriate for a different community, a power generation system is very different than heating system. And most of our projects are done in outside of natural gas territory where a community may have ample solar and wind opportunities, but that's not really going to affect their bottom line that much, whereas that same community might be spending tens of thousands of dollars per year in their heating bills for propane or fuel oil typically. And if biomass were on the table as an eligible technology, then they would be able to not only be advancing a renewable energy technology, keeping more of those dollars locally that would otherwise have been exported away from the local economy for expensive and volatilely priced fossil fuels, but they're also using a resource that's appropriate for them locally and saving dollars on making significant impacts on their bottom line. So for those reasons, we strongly support this bill, and we hope that it gets further this year.
Thank you. Bill.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough, Committee for the Record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. You've listened to the experts. Those folks know exactly what that bill entails. And this little handout you just got, it shows some of the facilities that started this program a few years back and the cost savings. What I'll just talk about is the jobs it's going to create in the forest, gathering up this woody material, the pellet making, and then also a key part of this bill is this stuff is built in Oregon, and I don't think we can lose on this bill right here. So I urge passage. Thank you.
Great. Any questions, colleagues? Okay, thank you. Thank you very much for all this very compelling testimony. We'll get this scheduled for a work session next week. Okay. Is there anyone else who wanted to speak to this bill? Seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 634. And colleagues, we are meeting tomorrow. We have a raft of land use bills.
Yep.
So something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Okay. With that, we are adjourned.
Eight to four.
Okay. With that, we are adjourned.